taking aim with
Ralph Youngman
and Maya Schoen. We're pleased to be back with you again during the WBAI Fun Drive. Today we're going to continue with a further excerpt from the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital. Oops, I got the title wrong.
No, you didn't. Well, that's right on target.
Oh, great. It's been a while. So, it's a four-CD package for your contribution of $100. The number to call, 212-209-2950. Let's look a little first, before we play the excerpt, at what is happening currently in the United States. U.S. foreclosure filings climbed 65% in April, and bank seizures more than doubled in April from a year earlier, as the mortgage industry efforts to modify loans fell short. These are the words of Bloomberg, the business agency, Bloomberg.com, their report on May 14th, with the title, Foreclosures Climb 65% as Loan Workouts Fall. What does it mean? It means that 243,300 properties are in some stage of foreclosure. This is the highest monthly total since RealtyTrack, a seller of default data, began its collections of information around the country. One in 519 households received a filing. Nevada, California, and Florida had the highest rates. It's absolutely astounding when you look at the information state by state. And furthermore, banks are going to seize 60,000 properties a month through December of this year. At that time, it's expected 1 million U.S. homes, or a quarter of all homes for sale, may be owned by the banks themselves. Astounding. And that is why we found it very important to present the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital. Very important to present so that each and every one of us understands what is taking place, the basis of it, what it means for working people, the assault on working people throughout the United States. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, Maya, we have to keep in mind, brothers and sisters, that the crisis of which we have tried to make a thorough documentation is only the little beginning. As the Sunday Telegraph made very clear at the time that we were broadcasting on March 23rd, when the Fed stepped in, quoting James Melcher, president of New York hedge fund Balestra Capital, we were facing pandemonium, the risk of a total meltdown. I don't think most people have any idea how bad this chain is, and I am still not sure that we can maintain the solvency of the U.S. banking system. That's James Melcher, president of New York hedge fund Balestra Capital. Bear Stearns had a total positions of $13.4 trillion in one company, greater than the United States national income, equal to a quarter of the world's GDP. In what they call notional terms, they were describing these contracts as swaps, swaptions, caps, collars, and floors, newfangled instruments, as the Telegraph described them, built on an asset base of the minimum. What are we talking about here? Speculative instruments that bear no relation to reality. How does that manifest itself? Consider this, brothers and sisters. $13.4 trillion was the speculative base of these derivative contracts for Bear Stearns. But their actual capital base, their actual money in hand, that from which this extrapolation was made, was $17 billion. That is 0.01%. And the reality is that the seizure of the 516 trillion derivative system, the seizure in crisis, Bear Stearns is 13 trillion. The derivative system affecting the capitalist economy is $516 trillion, equally based upon nothing but extrapolation from pieces of paper that have long ago foregone anything resembling a process of production. One important point. J.P. Morgan Chase bailed out, supposedly, was put into place to replace the holdings of Bear Stearns by the Fed. But as the Telegraph points pointed out, J.P. Morgan, quote, is up to its neck in this soup. It will have $90 trillion on its books now, one-sixth of the global market. Bear Stearns Chase is just as precarious as was Bear Stearns. J.P. Morgan Chase, yes, is just as precarious as Bear Stearns. The crisis is only at its little beginning, brothers and sisters. That is the significance of this series, brothers. We are trying to provide the documentation that will be the furniture for arming ourselves intellectually, politically, and ideologically for the imminent and immense crisis facing human society.
So go to your phone now, and we're going to play another excerpt from this series. And please, while you're listening, call, because this will be in your home very soon. 212-209-2950. The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital. Four incredible CDs. $100 contribution to WBAI. You can't go wrong. You're definitely making the correct decision. Keep listener-sponsored radio on the air 24/7. Remember, WBAI is the one and only station that brings you Taking Aim each and every week. Michael, let's go to the excerpt. And following the excerpt, we'll be discussing this further and new information, too, for the remainder of the program.
Charles Wyplos in the Financial Times. Glorifying a strong dollar when it is so weak means they do not care. It is Connolly without compassion, he writes. Jean-Claude Trichet, president of the European Central Bank, is thereby left bemoaning the excessive exchange rate moves. The economic conditions, says the Financial Times, surely call for medicine. If Mr. Trichet thinks the U.S. Federal Reserve is overreacting, he has a point. But the speed and scope of monetary easing by the Fed is unheard of. More worrisome is that it is not the right medicine. One ill is the bursting of the housing bubble, which is the consequence of the subprime folly of past years. Driving the interest rate to the floor will not solve the problem. Another ill is the continuing difficulty faced by banks as a consequence of their reckless lending and poor investment judgment. The rebound of anxiety amply demonstrates that massive easing of monetary policy is not working. The Fed is delaying the day of reckoning and in the process exporting the U.S. crisis, adopting policies that intentionally and not further weaken the dollar and further expand the global crisis.
Ralph, let's look into a little detail here as to how this evolved. And also, let's talk about what some of these institutions are. Because bandied about are names such as hedge fund. We know the expression to hedge our bets. And in effect, that is one of the purposes for a hedge fund. That's how it got its name. But in fact, a hedge fund is a collection of wealthy individuals and institutions. It's a partnership. It has aggressive investment strategies unavailable to regulated financial institutions such as banks, mutual funds. It is consequently these hedge funds, and it's the government that allows these hedge funds to exist. It's the government that says hedge funds are exempt from the rules and regulations governing these publicly monitored institutions by the SEC, such as mutual funds or the FDIC, the Federal Depository Insurance Company, which monitors banks. And it allows them to use aggressive techniques to make up all sorts of techniques, such as derivatives or swapping or program trading or leveraging their money to great extents. These hedge funds are approximately 30% of all fixed income security transactions in the United States, 55% of the derivatives with investment grade ratings, 55% of the trading volume of bonds that are bonds for emerging markets, and 30% of all equity trades. They are major part of the financial institutions in the United States. It is not just wealthy people who have investments over $1 million involved in these hedge funds, pension funds, and other institutional investors involved in these funds. And we get the venerable institutions such as Bear Stearns, Citigroup, all the banks, developing hedge funds. And it's these hedge funds that were collapsing as they had major investments in the subprime market.
Well, Maya, when you put down a fraction of the actual investment you want to make, you put down 5%, you put down a nickel on the dollar, and for your nickel, you get a dollar's value of speculative paper, which then becomes something against which further speculative investment is made. A derivative is made of the hedge fund speculative paper. Something is derived from something that has already been extrapolated from minimal core value. And the house of cards is built upon and built upon and built upon and speculation upon speculation, and it's traded and shuffled and pieces of paper are handed about with a fictive value. And dollars are handed around as if it's confetti paper. And fortunes are made overnight, but it's based upon nothing. It's based upon an inevitable collapse. Here is the Wall Street Journal on March 17th analyzing this very process. "The buck stops where?" is the headline. "In the credit market panic that it began in August, we have now reached a point of maximum danger. The global run on the dollar will become a rout. As the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee prepares to meet tomorrow, this should be its major concern. The Fed's main achievement has been to stir a global lack of confidence in the greenback. By every available indicator, investors are now fleeing the dollar for other currencies, seeking traditional safe havens as gold and commodities, oil surging to $110 a barrel, up from $70 as recently as September, gold above $1,000 an ounce, up from $700 in September. Speculators," this is the Wall Street Journal, "speculator adding to this commodity boom, betting that the Fed has thrown price stability to the wind in order to ease the U.S. credit woes. The problem is that the dollar weakness is making all these problems worse. The flight from the dollar has made U.S.-based investments less attractive when the U.S. financial system urgently needs to raise capital. And the commodity boom is translating into higher food and energy prices that are robbing American consumers of their income. In the name of avoiding a recession, a reckless monetary policy has made one more likely." And here's how the Wall Street Journal concludes. "What the U.S. and world economy do not need is a Fed that continues to insist that inflation expectations are, quote, well anchored, unquote, when everyone else knows they are not. The Fed must restore some kind of monetary credibility, or today's panic will become tomorrow's crash," quote unquote, the Wall Street Journal, "The Buck Stops Where," March 17th, 2008.
Ralph, the best reporting I found was done by the BBC, explaining and really going into the details of what is emerging in this fictive capital crisis of capitalism. And one of the articles in the BBC is the U.S. subprime crisis in graphics. They talk about the banking model where, as I mentioned before, mortgages are pooled together and then they sell this collection of mortgages that have been prepared by various mortgage institutions such as bank or mortgage companies, and they sell it on the bond market and then it is traded. This makes it easier for the institutions to then borrow more money because they've gathered the mortgage, but then they sell it off. In other words, they're not holding it. The mortgage bond market is now worth $6 trillion and is the largest single part of the $27 trillion U.S. bond market, and it's even bigger than the trading in Treasury bonds. The estimate by the brokerage firm Friedman, Billings & Ramsey is that there is $11 trillion, rather than what the BBC says of $6 trillion, in U.S. mortgage debt. But it's backed by only $590 billion in capital, or you can say 19 parts of debt to one part equity. this is not tenable, the brokerage firm says. That's why you're going to get collapse as people cannot meet their mortgages. Cleveland was considered the subprime capital of America. It's a working-class city. It's been hard hit by the decline of manufacturing, and it's sharply divided along racial lines. People were able to get cash by refinancing their homes, and often they were refinanced and they were given loans without having collateral and without making down payments. And this type of loan was an adjustable rate mortgage called an ARM. The payments were fixed for 2 years and then they would become higher and dependent upon the Fed interest rates. Well, it so happens that at the time, interest rates rose as these ARMs came off the freeze of the 2 years, and people couldn't meet their new monthly payments. One in five mortgages across the United States, and particularly in Cleveland, were subprime. These were popular, as I said, in places like Cleveland, where people were going in and selling them rapidly to people who wouldn't otherwise qualify for a mortgage. And they were also popular in Southern California, Arizona, Nevada, and the suburbs of Washington, D.C., as well as New York City. It's estimated that 2 million people will be evicted from their homes as the foreclosure cases work their way through courts.
Well, Maya, the BBC correctly calls this a subprime crisis, which has gone nationwide. And in the process of examining how it has gone nationwide, it states the property crash is affecting the broader economy. The building industry will cut its output by half, and that will lead to the loss of between 1 and 2 million jobs. And that's 15% of the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy is slowing to a point where there is no longer a growth rate of any substance. And it states the economic slowdown will get worse as the banks and other lenders cut back on credit that they will make available. They are rejecting most people who apply for credit cards, insisting on bigger deposits for house purchases and looking closely at applications for personal loans. There is a drying up of the wholesale bond market, and by the effect of the crisis on their own balance sheets. The banking industry is facing huge losses as a result of the subprime crisis. The bond market has collapsed, suffering huge losses of the bondholders, such as pension funds who bought subprime mortgage bonds. These have fallen sharply in value and are worth 20% of their original value. Do you understand what that means, brothers and sisters? Investments on the part of retirees and pension funds. Millions of people whose life savings are at stake, whose pensions are at risk, whose health care is on the line, investments have been made on their behalf in institutional holdings that are in a state of collapse. It is estimated, the BBC concludes, that ultimately losses suffered by financial institutions will be between $220 billion and $450 billion as the $1 trillion in subprime mortgage bonds is devalued. And here in the Washington Post, Steven Perlstein, the headline is Public Risk, Private Gain. With the acquiescence of federal regulators, Wall Street went hog wild. It grabbed gobs of money and in the process created a whopping mess the federal government now has to clean up. And that's the context of the Fed's decision to put $30 billion behind the rescue of Bear Stearns. As Nouriel Roubini, the New York University economist who has been predicting this debacle for more than a year, Perlstein writes, quote, "We've mastered the art of socializing risk and privatizing gain. That is the essence of capitalism, brothers and sisters. That's the nature of the dictatorship of capital in our society. That's the meaning of the capture of the state, which is its instrument for subsidizing the capitalist ruling class while pauperizing the mass of our population, exploiting our labor, profiteering over the productive forces that we are able to create. It is a society that is incapable of meeting the elementary needs of the mass of our people, and it is now in a protracted and unavoidable and uncontainable crisis.
Ralph, the BBC prepared a timeline of the subprime crisis. Remember, this is not the first crisis. We had the savings and loan crisis, again, based upon speculative investments in home mortgages, and there have been other crises, many other crises based upon speculation. We can discuss that in another show. On February 14th, they published this timeline, and it starts with 22nd of February of 2007 when HSBC, one of the major banks, fires the head of its U.S. mortgage lending business as losses reached $10.5 billion. March 8th, the biggest U.S. house builder, D.R. Horton, warned of huge losses from the subprime fallout. New Century Financial, one of the biggest subprime lenders in the United States, on March 12th, suspended trading in its company because it feared it would head for bankruptcy. Then March 16th, Accredited Home Lenders Holdings said it would sell $2.7 billion of its subprime loan book at a heavy discount in order to generate some cash for its business. On April 2nd, New Century Financial files for Chapter 11 after it's forced by its backers to repurchase billions of dollars of bad loans. This is another home mortgage company. And then UBS, one of the major banks, it has its U.S. subprime lending arm, Dillon Reed Capital, closed by UBS on May 3rd.
The BBC has performed a real service, brothers and sisters. It delineates literally company by company, collapse by collapse, the nature of this accumulating capitalist debacle. As Maya cites, UBS is seeking a capital plan backing. Union Bank Suisse boss Marcel Ospel told an angry shareholder meeting it is essential that they back a $13 billion Swiss franc overseas capital injection. Singapore's investment arm has bought shares in the bank for almost $10 billion, while an unnamed Middle Eastern investor has taken a stake. And the head of Union Bank Suisse confesses, "We failed to recognize the signals from the U.S. housing market in time. We judged the developments wrongly. I never thought that I would have to relinquish my responsibilities." And he states that the crisis of UBS is total. Rival financial giants, the BBC concludes, including Merrill Lynch, Citibank, and the major European banks, are struggling to repair their balance sheets after their disastrous subprime investments. And the BBC on the 14th, Crédit Agricole, hit by subprime, France's biggest retail bank, Crédit Agricole, made a loss in the last 3 months, hit by hefty charges at its Italian investment banking arm, worse than Crédit Agricole's forecast. It is on the verge of collapse, as is Société Générale, one of the largest banks in Europe that had been a target for takeover by Crédit Agricole, now hit by the subprime crisis. And here in the BBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank in $17 billion credit crisis loss, the UK's largest bank has made a $17.2 billion loss after the decline in the U.S. housing market hit the value of its loans. And again, central banks fight the credit crisis. This is the BBC again on the 14th of March. The world's largest central banks have launched their latest coordinated action to calm the jittery credit markets. The U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the central banks in the United Kingdom, in Canada, and Switzerland, seeking to inject billions of dollars to stabilize the money markets. And Evan Davis, the BBC economics editor, states, "It is not that the banks don't have cash to lend, it's that they don't trust each other to have sufficient assets." And again in the BBC, hedge fund on verge of collapse, Carlyle Capital Corporation, a unit of the private equity firm Carlyle Group, will not be able to meet lenders' demands for money. The U.S. mortgage-backed fund will collapse. as its lenders seize its remaining assets.
Ralph, that was on AAA-rated mortgages. The banking institutions don't trust anything that has to do with mortgage-backed securities anymore, because as you look through the year, not day by day, but actually if you get a global picture of the year, you see the failure of all these mortgage companies, such as Countrywide, or last August, American Home Mortgage, which is the largest U.S. independent home loan provider. It had filed for bankruptcy after it laid off the majority of its staff. And Countrywide, as I mentioned earlier in the show, was forced to be bought out by Bank of America. Last July, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke warned that the U.S. subprime lending market would cost the banks up to $100 billion. That would be the write-off. But recently, the economists for the G7 countries, the major industrial countries of the world, they said that the cost, actually, of this speculative housing market was going to be $400 billion worldwide. The ramifications of this we have been discussing during this show. And it's not something that couldn't have been predicted. The World Socialist website, in an article published recently, March 18th, Shades of 1929, Bear Stearns Collapse Signals Deepest Crisis Since the Great Depression, refers to Volume 2 of Karl Marx's seminal work, Capital. Marx makes the point about banks and financial houses. Quote, "The process of production appears merely as an unavoidable intermediate link, as a necessary evil for the sake of money-making. All nations with a capitalist mode of production are therefore seized periodically by a feverish attempt to make money without the intervention of the process of production," end quote. What Marx is talking about is the development of speculative instruments, such as derivative or these mortgage-backed securities. Ralph?
Well, Maya, here's an article by the Associated Press reporter Aaron C. Davis on March 17th, dated Sacramento, California. States' budget crises will hurt millions. Financially strapped states are looking to take away government health insurance and benefits from millions of Americans already struggling with a souring economy. An Associated Press review of the budgets in all 50 states reveals coverage will be eliminated for hundreds of thousands of poor children, disabled, and the elderly. Over 10 million people will lose dental care, access to specialists, name brand prescription drugs, and benefits. 20 million will see their care jeopardized by further cuts to doctors' reimbursements. Health care is a choice target as governors and legislators confront the worst deficits they faced in a decade or more. That's not their only target. They're also considering cuts in aid to schools and universities, shrinking the state workforces, releasing prisoners before their sentences are completed. The safety net programs for the elderly and the disabled and the out of work will be cut, even as the demand for these services is on the rise. Despite dire conditions, only a handful of the states are seriously considering tax increases or modest hikes on the wealthy to close the gaps. Instead, states are looking to increase lottery ticket sales, promote Indian gambling, or raise taxes on cigarettes and alcohol. These taxes disproportionately hit the pocketbooks of the same poor and working class that would be hurt by the spending cuts, the studies show, the article continues. Nearly two dozen states are grappling with deep cuts, tax proposals to close shortfalls totaling over $34 billion. That includes California, where lawmakers have made emergency cuts and authorized billions in bond sales, the half a deficit once projected at $16 billion through June 2009. A dozen states are joining. And this article continues, but I want to move on to the following. Big business is even more unpopular than you think, writes Robert Weissman on January 16, 2008. The United States public holds big business in shockingly low regard. A November 2007 Harris poll found that less than 15% of the population of the United States believe that the industries are to be considered honest or trustworthy. Tobacco companies, oil companies, managed care companies, HMOs, health insurance companies, telephone companies, life insurance companies, online retailers, pharmaceutical and drug companies, car manufacturers, airlines, packaged food companies, Electric and gas utilities, only 15% of adults say they trust the best-rated industry about which Harris surveyed in its poll. An amazing 84% told Harris that big companies have too much power in Washington.
Ralph, today is the fifth anniversary of the U.S. assault against Iraq, the shock and awe bombing, and then the U.S.-led invasion. While we're talking about the U.S. bailout of Wall Street and the financial institutions such as Bear Stearns, let us talk about the misappropriation of funds here in the U.S., as well as the death of the Iraqi people, the death of U.S. soldiers. And that is with the $3 trillion war. $3 trillion is estimated by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes of Harvard University. $3 trillion war. So far, according to the Congressional Budget Office, $413 billion has been spent on the war against Iraq.
Maya, 2 million people in Iraq, the blockade and the starvation included, have died. Almost 3 million internal refugees. The country almost entirely radioactive from the use of depleted uranium. And here in the CBS, the New York Times poll on January 13th, 75% of the people of the United States state the country is on the wrong track, matching the highest number ever recorded in the CBS New York Times poll. Concern about the direction of the economy, concern about the war in Iraq, concern about the profiteering of the large corporations, concern about the direction of the country. 6 in 10 Americans state they want the war in Iraq ended. This is a population in rising opposition, in resistance and disaffection, in profound alienation, registering the crisis overwhelming them and preparing for the struggles ahead.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital. Visit our website, www.takingaimradio.com.
Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital. You've heard one brief excerpt from this four-hour presentation, four CDs, $100 contribution to WBAI, 212-209-2950. Get on the phone right away. Ralph and I have been broadcasting since December 2001, thanks to WBAI. Thanks to you. You and your contributions that make WBAI possible, that sustain WBAI all these years, and consequently sustain Taking Aim and the information and analysis that we can bring to you. Now is the time for you to get on the phone, 212-209-2950. Thank you very much. I hear the phones ringing. Let's keep all the lines going. Michael is in the engineering booth. We're going to be thanking you. And remember, we need to hear the phones ringing. Volunteers have come in. They're in the pledge room, ready to take your calls. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I want to emphasize, brothers and sisters, that the crisis that we document, the realities of this permanent, enduring crisis of capital, is only the little beginning. You remember that we cited Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes about a $3 trillion war in Iraq. Well, that was based upon an assumption of crude oil being $40 a barrel. It's $127 a barrel. And consequently, today, Stiglitz and Bilmes stated that, in fact, the number would be at least $5 trillion going up. $5 trillion for this war? Well, brothers and sisters, the White House had to respond to Army Radio's report that Bush intends to attack Iran before the end of his term, and I'm quoting today's Jerusalem Post. The military option is on the table, and the administration is preparing an attack on Iran prior to the year's end. A top official in Jerusalem stated that senior members in the entourage of President Bush confirmed that Bush and Vice President Cheney, and I'm quoting the Jerusalem Post, stated that military action against Iran will occur. Now, the U.S. House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, stated on Sunday, no option is ruled out to stop Iran's march towards nuclear weapons. Iran must be stopped. They are a threat to the neighborhood. They are the source of funding for Hamas and Hezbollah, Pelosi told Channel One. The Democrats are lining up, whatever they may say, posturing in this presidential campaign. They are prepared for the major expansion of this addiction to arms and devastation and permanent war. And the economic and social consequences of this are only beginning to be registered. This crisis is only in its inception.
And that's why, Ralph, people must get on the phone now, 212-209-2950. To sustain WBAI, and our gift to you is the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital. Ralph?
Because we are attempting to prepare our listeners, our audience, our constituency, our many ardent supporters across this country and many others for the necessity of struggle. Here in today's paper, Global Survey reveals growing anger over social inequality, and the paper is the Financial Times. The significance of a poll conducted across Europe, Asia, and the United States by the Financial Times of London and the Harris polling firm. The quote is, income equality has emerged as a highly contentious issue in countries across the globe. The latest wave of globalization has created a superclass of rich people. The FT Harris poll found overwhelming majorities throughout Europe and the world, expressing the view that the social chasm between the financial elite and the population at large has grown too large. In Spain, 76% state that social inequality had grown to a point of no toleration. In Germany, the figure is 87%. In China, which is the low-wage manufacturing center of the world, 80% of the public poll said inequality in income was intolerable. In the United States, those who believe that this income gap has grown to a point of no longer being able to accept it are 78% of the population. You have a circumstance in which the Food and Agricultural Organization, according to the Financial Times, has registered that global food prices have risen by 45%, that basic commodities are soaring even higher, wheat by 130%, rice by 74%. 2.5 billion people, 40% of the world's population, living on less than $2 a day, when confronted by these spiraling food prices, are presented with the imminent specter of starvation, Financial Times. The FAO Director General, Jacques Diouf, cited as a key cause of the looming catastrophe, quote, financial speculation. Investment funds speculating on a futures market, profiteering over food prices, driving up the cost of commodities, and notably the elementary foodstuffs on which billions of people depend for survival. That is the reality, brothers and sisters. This crisis is only beginning to unfold.
212-209-2950, the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital. I'd like to hear the phones ringing. We're going to be on until 6 o'clock. Believe me, this is very important. Next week, the Fund Drive special on Tuesday is going to focus on the Nakba, a very important subject. And as you know, Ralph and I have been broadcasting about the Palestinian struggle ever since we've been on Taking Aim. And this is another one of the points at which we need to ask you to help sustain this program. Thank you. Thank you again. I hear the phones ringing again. Please, 212-209-2950. We prepared a very important gift for you, something that you're going to be listening to, not just in the immediate future, but you're going to be listening to in the years to come. Ralph was talking about the food crisis throughout the world, as the United Nations called it, a tsunami of hunger is growing. It's sweeping throughout the world. But here in the United States, it's hitting us, too. Government estimates 1.5 million new applicants for food stamps in this year alone. That's 1.5 new applications. 28 million people in the United States will be receiving food stamps. It's very hard to think of what that means. How many times the population of New York City? New York City with 9 million people, 28 million people, over three times the population of New York on food stamps. The federal food assistance is the largest program. This is the largest it's ever been. The 28 million since the program began in the 1960s. That is, more people are being served by food stamps, despite the fact that it's harder to get food stamps now.
Well, Maya,
1.1 million have been added to the jobless rolls in the past year. 1.1 more people without work. 232,000 jobs lost in the past 3 months alone. People who are unemployed because of lost jobs are now at 4.2 million people, and many of them are in the construction industry and the durable goods industries. Ralph?
Well, last week, Maya, the Financial Times published a column by David Rothkopf, who is the author of Superclass, the Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. Rothkopf is the former Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade for the Clinton administration. This is what he writes. Credit crisis is exacerbating an emerging backlash. Elites make billions on markets, whether they go up or down. Institutions win government support while the little guy is losing his home. Multinational chief executives 30 years ago made 35 times the wages of an average employee. Today it is over 350 times. The crisis has focused attention on the obscene inequities of our era. The world's 1,000 richest people have twice the assets of the poorest 2.5 billion. And Rothkopf continues in the Financial Times, the financial oligarchy is facing a response from the populations of the world unprecedented. The financial superclass is being presented with a resistance that they had never anticipated. Warning about the suffering that is caused by previous elites, Rothkopf states that the present financial oligarchy in the global economy is facing a response that matches what happened to, quote, the French aristocracy and Russia's Romanov dynasty. What they are talking about in the Financial Times is the fact that mass resentment is creating conditions for social upheavals and revolution. They are talking about this now openly in the major instruments think tanks of the bourgeoisie, of the ruling class, because their system is in terminal decay. And these programs and this documentation and this information is designed not merely to provide factual information to quote, but to arm us politically, ideologically, intellectually for the struggles ahead. You can be sure that this system, which is not only addictive to fictive capital and deficit financing, but addictive to arms production and addicted to war, is only in its beginning of expansion in its wars in the Middle East and in Central Asia and beyond. Iran for now, Syria next, Egypt after that, Afghanistan and Pakistan. This system requires permanent war, brothers and sisters. We need to be preparing for the resistance that we must mount, because repression accompanies war, repression accompanies crisis. And none of these capitalist parties has the beginning of an answer to this permanent, enduring, and systemic crisis of capitalism.
And if you want to continue hearing the voice of Ralph Schoenman, right now you need to be speaking to the people in the Pledge Room. 212-209-2950. WBAI depends upon the support of each and every one of you listening today, listening whether you're in the tri-state area of New York, listening whether you're in Michigan, Texas, California, Utah, Wyoming, Baltimore, Maryland, wherever you are, listening whether you're overseas in the 77 countries where people are taking down the Taking Aim programs. Please, now is the moment. Get on the phone, 212-209-2950. And if you're listening to the show from our archive, again, call WBAI and tell the people in the Pledge Room at any time or day that you want this Taking Aim premium, the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital. Please do so now. That is the only way that we can come to you each and every week. That is the way we have been coming to you each and every week since December of 2001. This wouldn't be possible without WBAI, and that's why we prepare wonderful gifts of our programs for you and new programs and lectures. All of our premiums we prepare just for you. I was talking about the unemployment figures, and remember, people who are listed as unemployed are people who are still searching for jobs. That is, an unemployment lasts maybe a year or 18 months. It depends upon the state of unemployment in the country, how long they let you collect. But the Bureau of Labor Standards figure for the actual unemployed in the United States is always that much higher because people give up looking for work. They just cannot find it. And that's 13.9 million people. This doesn't count the people who are working part-time, who are on subsistence. In other words, they can't find enough work in a full-time job. They can only find one part-time job, or they're out creating their own work, precarious work, such as a flea market or trying to sell something on the Internet or trying to make with the eBay or some of these other plans where they're gathering up books or they're, some people are picking up recycled cans and taking them to the recycling center. You see that happening more and more. People just trying to make ends meet in this country that's supposed to be the supposed wealthiest country in the world. Where does this wealth go? Well, we know that over half of the tax money, the disposable income for the U.S. budget, is going to the military-industrial complex, to these wars of depredation throughout the world, as Ralph was mentioning before, with the $5 trillion now cost of just the assault on Iraq alone. 212-209-2950. Please, I don't hear the phones ringing. We have the people in the pledge room, the wonderful volunteers who come down to 120 Wall Street, WBAI Studios. It's your contribution that keeps this show on the air. Michael, we're hoping you're going to thank some of the people on air. We're broadcasting from California, and Michael G. Haskins, our wonderful announcer and engineer, is in the studio, and we'll be thanking each and every one of you individually. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I want to emphasize here that greed is not the issue. What David Rothkopf writes in the Financial Times about the enormous profiteering, speculative grasping of the financial oligarchy is but a symptom. And when Rothkopf is advising the final financial oligarchy to save itself from its excesses while time permits, he is not really addressing the issue. Because it is fundamentally rooted not in the rapaciousness and arrogance of those who profit off financial speculation, those who unleash famine over large parts of the world. It is the workings of capitalism itself. The World Socialist website cited a passage by Marx which is right on point. Written 140 years ago, Marx wrote The Theory of Increasing Misery to explain an inherent feature of capitalist production. Quote, accumulation of wealth at one pole is at the same time accumulation of misery, agony of toil, slavery, ignorance, brutality, mental degradation at the opposite pole, on the side of the class that produces its profit in the form of capital. Now, no element of Marx's analysis has been subject to more ridicule by the capitalist moguls than this prediction of increasing immiseration of the mass of humanity, of this demonstration of the relationship between a system of private profit and increasing exploitation, decreasing productive value, ever-escalating speculation, and inherent crisis. Marx's analysis is confirmed not just in the cold language of statistics, but in the increasingly explosive struggle of masses confronted with the impossibility of obtaining the essential means of survival. And that is the reality that is overwhelming the planet today. We live in a working-class city in Northern California, Vallejo, California. It's a town that used to be based on ship production, long in decline as productive forces have been annihilated in Vallejo. 11,000 homes have been put into foreclosure since this crisis began in the small city of Vallejo itself. In fact, Vallejo is the first city in California to go bankrupt. The city is bankrupt. Who do you think was getting $200,000 a year in this city of bankruptcy? The police department, brothers and sisters. Those are the relationships of capital. We live in a working class city, an overwhelmingly black and Filipino city and a neighborhood in which people are being immiserated. And our brothers and our sisters and our friends and neighbors are conscious of the meaning of this. It's as in Vallejo, so in the United States and on a global scale. What we are doing with this broadcasting, brothers and sisters, is attempting to provide the furniture for resistance, the information that we need, the understanding that is a prerequisite to building, to organizing, to preparing for not just the immiseration, but the repression, for building an instrument of change, transformation, for transforming this system through struggle. That's the meaning of the broadcasting. That's the rationale for Free Speech Radio. That's the importance of your support for this work. We are in this together. It's not a spectator sport, as Maya said. Please, brothers and sisters, 212-209-2950. It's the little beginning of a preparation for a struggle involving us all.
212-209-2950. We have 5 minutes more in this hour of programming. Please, get on the phone now. Don't wake up at 8 o'clock tonight thinking, oh, my goodness, I didn't call and make my contribution. I didn't call and get the crisis, the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital, this important 4-CD series. It's too late then. Do it now. Get to your phone now, 212-209-2950. If you're in transit, you're commuting home from work, as soon as you get home, get on the phone. 212-209-2950. We've been talking about the impoverishment, the assault on working people, but it doesn't have to be that way. It's with this information, with the statistics, with the analysis that we arm ourselves. That's why our program is called Taking Aim. We are taking aim at the ruling class. We are arming each and every one of you with knowledge, with analysis, with the instruments that you need to be effective organizers. Please get on the phone, 212-209-2950.
Maya, Mark Lynas wrote in the New Statesman in London on April 17th, how the rich starve the world. World cereal stocks are at an all-time low, food aid programs have run out of money, and hundreds of millions face starvation. Global grain stockpiles on which all of humanity depends are perilously depleted. Cereal stocks are at their lowest level for 25 years, according to the FAO. The world has consumed more grain than it has produced for 7 of the past 8 years, and supplies at roughly only 54 days of consumption are the lowest on record. The president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, has warned that 100 million people are being pushed into starvation, because food price rises caused directly by the imbalance between supply and demand are being suffused by speculation and greed. Even consumers in rich countries, the article states, are suffering on a scale unprecedented. We pay higher prices for food to subsidize the biofuels industry. This is not a short-term price blip, but the beginnings of a major structural change in the world food market, brothers and sisters.
And Ralph, the collapse of Bear Stearns and the crisis of fictive capital is addressing the what has happened in the development of capitalism as it shifts from production for need, for use, or even for artifice to speculation, the reliance on speculation. And nowhere is that more meaningful than in New York City. As the New York Times noted on March 24th, when Louise's story came out with her report, with economy tied to Wall Street, New York braces for job cuts. Because in New York, the finance industry is responsible for nearly a third of all wages earned in the city. This is the highest in modern times. And each Wall Street job supports three workers in other sectors, the service sectors, the entertainment sectors, the other sectors of the city. And think about what that means. As Bear Stearns has had 14,000 employees, there are layoff notices that have gone to 5,000 of them already. So each of those workers supports three other workers. So there alone, you have 15,000 workers within New York who are impacted by the collapse of Bear Stearns. But it doesn't stop with Bear Stearns. Shearson Lehman, announced layoffs of 1,400 people 2 weeks ago. Citigroup was in the process of cutting 10% of its workforce in its investment bank division, 6,000 people, many of whom work in New York. As the New York Times noted that since August, the financial industry, this is August of last year, shed at least 20,000 jobs, some of them selling loans, those bundling loans into those complex speculative securities bonds, and those placing placing bets on the likelihood that borrowers would even pay their mortgages. And that's even the derivatives of what we were talking about with the funny money. So please, the crisis.
Ralph and Maya, we have about 4 minutes left, and we have some thank yous. We have some people have made their pledges to WBAI for Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. And I was, you know, it's interesting you should mention Bear Stearns. I was over by Bear Stearns here in New York City a couple of weeks ago, and I saw, you know, the police barricades inside the lobby of Bear Stearns, and I wondered what that was about. It was a little off-putting to see that inside the lobby. It's looked rather unusual. Usually you see that outside the on the streets, but inside the lobby of Bear Stearns, I don't know if is that relevant at all, but it just was a little off-putting
to
see that.
Well, it's very indicative, Michael. What you're describing is very important, because the world's population is under siege from these companies, but the police of the world are protecting the offices of those who are creating the crisis. They are protecting the persons, the office, and essentially the institutions and the power.
Mm. And they are worried about the employees themselves who are losing their jobs.
That's exactly what I thought. Well, in any event, we'll leave that to you to give us further analysis as the weeks unfold and as this situation, as this crisis unfolds. Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Before I do forget, I'd like to thank the restaurant Madiba at 195 DeKalb Avenue at Carlton. They provide lunch to the volunteers here at WBAI. Area restaurants provide lunch and dinners to the volunteers at WBAI. Folks have come down to the radio station to help answer phones and take pledges. And Walkers will be providing dinner. The Walkers is 16 North Moore Street. That's in Manhattan. We thank those folks so very, very much. And we also thank Chris Meyer from Allenhurst, New Jersey, for calling in with a pledge of support for Taking Aim, and Larry Reinhardt from the Bronx, 212-209-2950. Thank you very much, Andrea Sears, the engineer, or rather the editor for the WBAI Evening News, with that very necessary backup. Nicole Williams from Brooklyn, New York, thank you so very much. Marilyn Voight Downing, Marilyn Voight Downey, thank you very much. A little hard
thank
to
you,
see
Marilyn. Marilyn has been one of the most articulate and effective voices for change and for struggle, a militant and activist. We're very grateful to Marilyn.
Thank you, Marilyn. Thank you very, very much. And Michael J. Collins from Hicksville, New York, calling in with a pledge of support for Taking Aim, and Andrew Cota from Caldwell, New Jersey, calling in for Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen here on WBAI.
Well, Michael, I want to emphasize here that what we were describing just now reflects the fact that the worldwide agricultural giant, Archer Daniels Midland, revealed a 42% leap in quarterly profits in the last few days. As the food stocks of the world go into crisis, and as the escalation of cost pushes food out of the reach of hundreds of millions of people, a 42% leap in quarterly profits is announced. Volatility in the commodities market presents unprecedented opportunities, said ADM chief executive Patricia Wirtz. In opportunities for a handful of criminals, mass misery and starvation for humanity at large. Those are the issues, brothers and sisters. That's the struggle for us that lies ahead.
Ralph and Maya, would you give your contact information out? Because we're out of time.
Okay, you can reach us at Taking Aim at PacBell, that's PacBell.net. Taking Aim at PacBell.net, and our website is TakingAimRadio.com. We'll be with you next week with a discussion of the Nakba. Join us then.
Thank you so very much. Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen here on WBAI. We're at 99.5 FM, and thanks to all of you for calling up and pledging your support to keep this radio station on the air. It's 6 p.m. in New York City. Please stay tuned for a report of some of the day's events.